I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Welcome to Unexplained Extra, with me, Richard McLean Smith, where for the weeks in between episodes, we look at stories and ideas that for one reason or other, didn't make it into the previous show. In our last episode, To Mourn Names, we took a deep dive into the beguiling mystery of the so-called Somerton Man. Some of you may recognize this story as a chapter taken from my book, and as many of you will know, there's been quite a significant development to the story since I wrote it, namely that the man appears to have finally been identified. However, rather than amend the story, I thought it might be better to have someone else, a little more qualified, explain the latest developments. And so for this week's extra, we're going to do something a little different. Physicist and electronic engineer, Professor Derek Abbott of the University of Adelaide has perhaps done more than anyone to help uncover the Somerton Man's identity. In July 2021, he made the stunning announcement that thanks to his tireless work and that of genealogist Colleen Fitzpatrick, they had finally cracked the mystery.
That kind of leads me to my first question, I suppose, which is, when did you first hear about the Somerton Man mystery? Is this something that you presumably weren't aware of before you went to Australia?
Correct. I had never heard about it. And the first time I heard of it was about 95. I just happened to be in a laundromat watching my clothes whiz around and picked up one of those magazines that they leave in there. And there was an article about the top 10 unsolved mysteries in Australia. And I think this was ranked as number two.
Right.
One was the disappearance of Harold Holt, and put it down, never did anything with it until 2007, where I saw an extended newspaper article which gave a lot of detail and even reprinted the so-called Somerton Man's Code that he had written on the back of a poetry book. And so that's what got my interest up at the beginning. I thought, okay. I have no idea whether this actually is even a code or not in the first place, but let's see if I can set this for a project for my students and do some statistical tests on the letters and see if we can determine if it's a code or not.
You say your students, what was your job at the time?
Well, I'm a professor at the University of Adelaide and in the electrical engineering department, and doing statistical analysis of data is something we do. And, crypto security and things is another thing we do. So we know about codes. So I got my students over the years to a set of many projects to various different students. And We looked at it over and over again and compared it against all known World War II type ciphers. And we were able to eliminate virtually all of them. And it's looking like it isn't actually a code. It just looks like the first letters of words in the English language.
Right.
We can say it's actually English because we've tested it against other first letters of words in other languages, and English always comes out tops statistically. So that's what we think it is. And so we think it's just something pedestrian, that, you know, it's just an aide de mémoire. It's just mm-hmm. the first letters of words. It could be anything. It could be, you know, his horse betting strategy, or trying to solve a puzzle in a newspaper. It could, we don't think it's anything conspiratorial.
Right. And was it actually written in the book, or was it sort of marked onto, sort of scored onto it?
It was on the back cover.
Okay.
And it was very light. So it's unclear from the old newspaper reports whether it was very lightly penciled or whether it was just a press through from another page.
Right.
My guess, it was just very, very light pencil.
And so, yes, yeah, so interestingly, it's actually, you know, not only is it not a code, but probably not relevant to the specific book, therefore, or the phone numbers that were also found in the book.
Yes, there was some, right next to the so-called code were some numbers. One turned out to just be a local bank, and another turned out to be a lady who had trained as a nurse, who lived, in fact, 5 minutes away from where the man was found dead, 5 minutes walk away. So joining the dots, the police thought, well, she must know something about this guy.
Yeah.
So knocked on her door and said, you know, have you seen this book before? And she said, yes. And they go, aha, so you know about this guy found dead on the beach. And she goes, she backpedals and says, oh, no, I just meant I've seen a Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam before, which is what the book was.
Right.
And so they dragged her in to see a plaster cast they had made off the dead body. So it's a death mask. I ought to add that this had happened about 6 months after he had died.
Yes.
So they dragged her in to have a look at the plaster cast. And apparently she was quite evasive and very uncommunicative and behaved very strangely. She just looked down at the floor for the whole interview and didn't even look at the plaster cast.
Right.
And so the police thought she knew something, but they didn't push her because, you know, this wasn't classed as a homicide. If you look at the police file, they always believed it was actually a suicide. That was their their strong belief. And, you know, if it was classed as a homicide, you know, they could put the heavies on her, but but that was not the case here. And so they just let her go.
Right.
So there's me with the working on the code many years later, and the so-called code. And, you know, at the beginning of my work, you know, I didn't really know if it was a code or not. I hadn't come to any conclusions. So I was thinking, well, if it is a code, maybe I'm going to need some context. Maybe I need to find out this lady's name. Perhaps her name is a key to this code or something right. like that. So I set about trying to find out who she was because her name was never published. But they did publish sufficient detail that the newspapers said, you know, which hospital she had trained in, the Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney, and that she lived very close to where the man was found dead and stuff like that. So using the hospital records and electoral roll records and stuff, I was able to figure it out. It was like a huge jigsaw puzzle.
Right.
And but, yes, I found it, and her name was Jo Thompson. That's the name she went by.
Right. So that comes from your work. So I didn't know that.
Yes. Well, it was known to police, but, they had never let that out.
Right.
And so it was confirmed later by police that are alive who did know her name, and they did confirm that. And so she was born Jessie Harkness, but went by the name Jo Thompson later in life.
Right.
Spelled Jacob, which I believe is a bit of a Scottish name, isn't it? And her heritage, if you trace her family tree back, does go back to Scotland, in fact.
Right. So she was also known as Jessica, is that right? And Jestin, is that because I've read that too?
Well, she was born Jessie Harkness was her maiden name. But then she changed her first name. Well, she was known as Jo to all her family and friends.
Right.
I think it was her husband her husband-to-be that nicknamed her that. On her gravestone, it doesn't say Jessie, though. It says Jessica. Because, it's descendants that put stuff on gravestones, and the person who's buried is never responsible for it.
The work you put into that, finding out her name, at this point, are you kind of becoming more interested in getting to the bottom of the mystery? How does this sort of expand into?
Yeah, so I was starting to, after I found the context, found out this lady's name and found more context of the time, it sort of drew me in. I got really interested in all the events of the time. I was realizing more and more that this wasn't a code as time went on. And so I thought, actually, the real problem here is to identify the man, not the code. The code is just a distraction. What would be really interesting is to find out who he is. It's around 2010, I in fact noticed that the plaster bust, which is in the police museum here, actually has hairs embedded in it because it was molded directly off the dead body.
Right, wow.
And you can tell these are real hairs that came off the body and aren't just something off the mortuary floor, because they're all standing on end, all in formation, ripped directly off the body. So I thought, aha, this is a potential source of DNA. So I got some permission in 2011 to grab some hairs out of the bust, which we did. And unfortunately, the technology of the time wasn't good enough to extract DNA from hair, let alone hair that old. So anyway, we bit the bullet, and in 2015, our DNA lab at Adelaide University had a go. We selected the three best hair roots that we had and tried to get some DNA out of them. It did test positive for DNA. There was actually DNA there, so that was encouraging. But we got absolutely virtually nothing out of it. We got no sequence. All we were able to get was what's called his maternal haplogroup. And so we knew his mother's group was H, and that's all we knew. So it was a little bit disappointing, but also exciting that at least there was viable DNA in there. And so then in 2018, we had another crack at the lab at the university, and bingo, we got the whole mitochondrial genome. That's all the DNA from the mother's side. Unfortunately, that's not the sort of DNA you need to identify somebody. To identify somebody like this, where you don't have any comparison to compare the person with, what you need to do is upload it on genealogical DNA websites and find nearest cousins, like ancestry.com and stuff like that. Now, those websites, people may or may not know this, the DNA they use is quite different to what police do. Police use quite long strands of DNA, long sequences, roughly around 23 markers, depending on what jurisdiction you're in. Usually it's around 20 to 23. These DNA websites don't do that. They use much shorter DNA markers, and they use anywhere between 500,000 to 2 million of them. It's a completely different ballgame. It's the part of the DNA that's inherited from both the mother and the father. So the mitochondrial genome, which we extracted, was no good. We needed the part of the DNA that's the mixture of both parents. And these are called the autosomes. We only got 16,000 of those, and which was a huge breakthrough, but not enough. It's way below 500,000, which is what's really needed. So I tried my best at seeing if I could make do with the 16,000, and it just didn't work. It was a big flop.
Now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. It can be tough to train your brain to stay in problem-solving mode when faced with a challenge in life, but when you learn how to find your own solutions, there's no better feeling. A therapist can help you become a better problem solver, making it easier to accomplish your goals, no matter how big or small. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change therapists if needed. It's more affordable than traditional online therapy, and financial aid is available. Just fill out a brief survey and get matched with a therapist today. When you want to be a better problem solver, therapy can get you there. Visit betterhelp.com/unexplained10 today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/unexplained10.
Around beginning of this year, in fact, I had another go. This time I used a lab in the USA, which had some latest cutting edge technology for extracting DNA from hair. And so I took my best hair root, sent it off to them that I'd nervously saved up since 2011, always. So it's over 10 years. Yeah. And guess what? It was a big flop. It didn't give us a sequence. And so I was mortified. This is my best hair root that I'd saved up. So then went to plan B and sent them 5 centimeters of hair shaft with no root. And guess what? We got 2 million markers.
Wow.
Yeah. So what we're able to do is, with those 2 million markers, we're able to upload it and find his nearest cousins that are alive today. And his top hit was a chap in Victoria, Australia, which is a state next door to me. The other closest matches were also in Victoria. So straight off, this was not looking like a Russian spy after all, or a American or whatever. Another part of the story is, another twist to the whole story, which we haven't gone into yet, is that Joe Thompson had a son born out of wedlock who mysteriously had features that looked rather like the Somerton man. And one of the theories was perhaps he's the son of the Somerton man. So what I was able to do was compare the DNA of the Somerton man to his daughter that's alive, the daughter of Joe Thompson's son, that is, who also I happen to be married to, so that's another little twist. I don't know if you've explained that to the audience yet.
No, I haven't at all. So if you don't mind, are we able to go into that a little bit? Because, that is extraordinary. My main question was, at what point did you meet your wife in this sort of journey of yours, so to speak?
I met my wife around 2010. It was basically because Joe Thompson had passed away 2 years before I found out who she was. And then I thought, well, I should interview her son, Robin. But he had passed away like literally 2 months before I figured out how to contact him. So then I thought, well, does he have any descendants? So I interviewed a daughter of his, Rachel, and we hit it off and decided to get married the next day. So
that's incredible.
And then we really did get married about 3 months later. So wow. Being married to her, obviously I had her DNA on tap. And so immediately, that's the first thing I did when we got the Somerton man's 2 million markers, is compare it against my wife. And guess what? Absolute zero match. Not a single skerrig in there.
And can I just ask as well, was there not a story, I thought I've read at some point that Jo Thompson had said something at some point much later in her life in relation to the man's identity. Was that a fabrication in the paper, or had she alluded to knowing him at some point?
People always said they thought she knew something, but she never admitted it.
I see.
So what you've probably been reading is probably people saying that, I bet she knew something.
Yeah, right.
So, yes, so we ruled out my wife being related, and hence her father. So that was interesting. So, so we eliminated that possibility, and then we started looking at these nearest cousins that were in Victoria. So the fact they were from Victoria, Australia, meant straight away that, you know, these are the top matches. So, you know, this guy's obviously not some Russian spy or American or whatever. It kind of eliminated all the fanciful theory straight away. Just some ordinary bloke from the state next door. So from the top match, what we're able to do is, and this is myself and Colleen Fitzpatrick from America, who's an expert genealogist. We worked on this together and built out the family tree. And because we were working in the dark and, you know, we didn't know which direction the tree would go in and stuff like that, where to look in the tree, we obviously just went ballistic and just built out the tree to had 4,000 people on it in the end.
Wow.
And then it seemed this chap in Victoria connected to a family quite quickly called Keane, K-E-A-N-E.
Right.
And this is quite significant because, as we all know, the Somerton man had the name Keane written on some items of his clothing, written in India ink. And he even had a laundry bag with the name Keane stenciled on it.
Right.
And laundry bags with stenciled names is a very sort of World War II army type thing. So what's he doing with these items with the name Keane on them? So Colleen immediately said, oh, I bet he's a Keane because, you know, he's connecting to this Keane family. And so she was, pardon the pun, very keen on this hypothesis. And we were looking at these Keanes and we couldn't find any of them missing. They were all fine. They all were well accounted for and had dates of death way after 1948. We're thinking, back to the drawing board. And I was saying to Colleen, you know, I think this whole Keane thing is a distraction. It's a coincidence. You know, it's a common name. Okay, so there's somebody on this family tree of 4,000 with the name Keane, and he happens to have that name on his tie. You know, it could just be a coincidence. And so I say to her, look, I think we better move on. And so what we do is we then find, we then look at other people on the tree that don't have dates of death.
Right.
And that can happen for all kinds of reasons, you know, birth, deaths, and marriage offices, you know, particularly in the world from World War II times, you know, can have information lost, you know, or there could be some flood or something.
Yep.
But it's a good place to start. So we did find a couple of people close to this Keane family that looked like they didn't have a date of birth. One of them we were able to find a photo for, and Colleen was saying, well, this photo does look a bit like the Somerton man. And I was saying, no, it doesn't look like him to me, you know. But that's the trouble with old fuzzy photos. You can make them look like anything you want, really.
Right.
And so we had a bit of a disagreement over that. And then another chap, a person of interest, was a guy who was born by the name Carl Webb in 1905, but went by the name Charles Webb.
Right.
Later in life. You know, no date of death, couldn't find a photo on him. But we thought, well, look, we ought to check this one as well. So what I did was, because the tree had been built out through the Keane family, which was in fact by marriage, because his sister Frieda had married a guy called Keane, what we thought we should do is, well, go away from that side of the family tree and look at the Somerton man's mother and tunnel her tree down and find somebody on that side of the family that is alive today and test their DNA. And so we did. And guess what? It didn't match. It was a big flop. So there's another twist. And I thought, oh my God, what's gone wrong here? And here's the twist. The twist is that the Somerton man's mother, or Charles Webb's mother, I should say, is her maiden name was Grace, but we found out that her supposed father wasn't Mr. Grace. It was another chap.
Wow.
It was Mr. Morris. And I don't think she ever knew herself who her real dad was.
Wow. How did you find that out?
That was interesting. There were some genealogists already on Ancestry.com who looked like they had figured this out. And so by poking around on family trees there, we saw that. And the interesting thing about this was Colleen went straight for this. She said, yep, this is right. He's a Morris. And I'm actually skeptical. So it's me going, I'm not sure there's enough evidence for this. Because, it looks like there's some suppositions here and things like that. So what we did is let's say it is Morris then. So we tunneled down mother's side family tree, assuming the correct father now, and get this part of the family tree correct. Find an alive person who was prepared to, a live descendant who's prepared to be tested. So I rang him up and he was very helpful, and he agreed. And I think a couple of months later, his DNA came through and it was a match. Bingo.
It's amazing.
So get this. Not only did we get this match, and so not only did it prove straight away that, Charles Webb is the Somerton man, because we've got a triangulation now from two distant different parts of the family tree meeting a point. So it's a triangulation. But it also proves that his mother was really a Morris all in one hit.
Yeah.
Then what we did is usually with this sort of work, one doesn't just do one confirmation. One looks for many. So what we're able to then do is look to see who else is on the database that's close to our new chap that we had just found, and see if they also matched the Somerton man. And we found another one. So we found another triangulation point. And then what I was able to do is contact close descendants of Charles Webb. So I found a granddaughter of one of his sisters. And I also found a great grandson and great granddaughter of his eldest brother. And so got all these people tested. And every time it was a fantastic match. And the amount of DNA overlap just kept increasing and increasing as we got, these closer family relatives. It's just now completely beyond all reasonable doubt that, Charles Webb is the Somerton man.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I mean, how did they feel? I mean, firstly being approached, but secondly, sort of finding themselves now part of this story in a way. Is it something, because I guess the whole thing about the story of the Somerton man is there's a sort of ethical question about whether this is, maybe he wanted to die anonymously, maybe there's an element of that wanting to sort of retreat from the world, and we are now interested in trying to sort of stir that back up in a way, maybe against the man's wishes. But did actually people find it, were they thankful? Was it a sort of reassuring thing?
Well, they were thankful. They were very pleased to help, and without exception. It just so happens that, all the people I contacted were actually genuinely interested in their own family tree.
Yeah.
Some of them had even drawn out their family tree and did wonder what happened to Uncle Charlie.
So, yes.
You know, and there was no oral history that had been passed down from their family to say what had happened to him.
Yeah.
So they were quite pleased to have it all worked out.
Could you tell us what we do know about Charles Webb, or what you know, or what has been found out about him?
So what we've been able to find out now is that Charles Webb was born in 1905. His dad was a German immigrant from Hamburg, and his mum was a local, I believe, of Scottish ancestry originally.
Right.
So there you go, another Scotland connection there. And his dad was basically a baker. They grew up in various towns in Victoria, close to Melbourne. And his dad worked in various different bakeries. He seemed to change jobs quite a lot, but finally settled in 1928 and bought his own bakery in a little town called Springvale, which is now part of Melbourne. Not so little anymore, but it was a little tiny place back then. And so they had the bakery in Springvale. And so Charles and his brother Roy worked at the bakery. Also, I believe his older brother Richard Russell. And it seems by 1928, the sisters had all left home and got married. Richard had also actually left home, but it seemed he came into work at the bakery. So, but the two brothers were still at home and lived at the bakery with their parents and were working there. And it seems also around 1928 that he had trained as an electrical fitter, an instrument maker, but also appears that he was also working at the bakery all at the same time. So and we haven't been able to find his place of work. So I'm just wondering whether he was, you know, working at the bakery, but also kind of doing it. It's electrical work on a contract basis, something like this. This is what I'm thinking, because it seems like he was doing two jobs at once, as far as I can see.
Yeah.
So this could possibly explain why there are no work colleagues.
Of course, yeah.
Counting him as missing. The explanation why no family members came forward to say, look, this chap's missing, is if you look at the family, it seems it was one big happy family around 1928, but around 29, Richard, his eldest brother, his wife dies young, mm-hmm. And leaves him small children, which he then has to farm out to an orphanage.
Right.
And then his brother Roy dies in 1943 in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
His nephew, John Keane, dies in 1943, also in World War II. His dad dies in 1939, just after selling the bakery.
Right.
And then his mum dies in 1946. And basically, all these events happen over this short space of time, and basically the family becomes all fragmented.
Yep.
You know, and it's the war as well, yep. Just after World War II. And so they're all fragmented. They've had all these deaths, and they're probably not all speaking to each other anymore. You know, I'm sure people are familiar with the idea of it happens in all families. You know, there are deaths and turns of events, and families just don't speak to each other anymore after a while. It happens. And then in 1947, Charles and his wife separate. So obviously she's not speaking to him anymore either. And she files for divorce on grounds of desertion. She doesn't know where his whereabouts is. And 47 is the last time we see him on any documentation. He drops off any electoral roll records or anything like that. He's just right. Totally disappears off the record. So it's very interesting. So... And why did he go to Adelaide of all places? That's a bit mysterious. He's living, a resident of Victoria. Why did he travel by train to Adelaide and you know, go lie down on the beach and die?
Yeah.
Very strange.
And why the book in the car?
Yeah, that's another thing. So there's still many strange mysteries that we'll probably never know. And the mystery will I think the mystery will still live on. And I think the internet conspiracy theorists will still believe he's some sort of spy. You know, these things will never go away, I'm sure. We do have a possible hypothesis why he went to Adelaide of all places. And a strange twist is in his wife's divorce papers, divorce affidavit, she lists her address as being in South Australia.
Right.
Which is the state where Adelaide is. So that's very interesting. But we don't know the date that she actually arrived here. But if we just pretend that perhaps she was here already, perhaps it was her that he had come to see.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's a mystery, something for the internet sleuths to ponder on.
What's next for you in regards to the case? Are you going to continue? Is there more to find out that you're interested to know? And you mentioned also going do some work on the Voynich manuscript. Is that something also you're doing?
Yeah. So, yeah, we're doing work on the Voynich manuscript. I probably should be spending more time on that and less time on this now, because I think I've squeezed out about as much as anyone can find on this case. I don't think we're going to find any other big nuggets on the Somerton Man. So maybe it's time to let this go and look at the Voynich. So, yeah, we're working on that fast and furiously. And you know, we might have some interesting results on that by next year to announce.
Wow, look forward to hearing that. Thank you very much. Really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
If you enjoy Unexplained and would like to help support us, you can now do so via Patreon. To receive access to ad-free episodes, just go to patreon.com/unexplainedpod to sign up. Unexplained, the book and audiobook, featuring 10 stories that have never before been covered on the show, is now available to buy worldwide. You can purchase through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Waterstones, among other bookstores. All elements of Unexplained, including the show's music, are produced by me, Richard McLean Smith. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to podcasts, and feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or ideas regarding the stories you've heard on the show. Perhaps you have an explanation of your own you'd like to share. You can reach us online at unexplainedpodcast.com or Twitter at unexplainedpod and Facebook at facebook.com/unexplainedpodcast.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets,
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.